Good morning. It is nice to see everyone here this morning, and we're especially thankful for you if you're visiting with us. We're almost visiting ourselves, it seems, after being out for nearly 3 months, and just now, and this last month, getting back to worshiping together. For those of you who may not know, we are without a regular evangelist at this time, so different men of the congregation have been taking turns doing the lessons, and I think it's been about 4 months, close to 4 months since I preached. And in that time, I had lessons in various stages of development, and one I actually had in mind that I was going to preach this morning, but I have been compelled to speak on recent events and what's been going on in our world and our country over the past few weeks. And part of me is very reluctant to do that, because what has been happening is so politically and racially and emotionally charged. I'm concerned that I might say something that someone might find offensive or insensitive at the very least. And before I begin, I want you to know that I have no desire whatsoever to get political this morning. That is not my intention, nor to be any way dismissive of wrongs individuals may have suffered in this society. My only desire is for us to look at what's been going on in the world around us and to attempt to examine it from a purely biblical perspective, the perspective we as Christians all need to have, and to determine what is the response we should have to what's going on in the world around us. And if I do say anything you take offense with or disagree with, please don't hesitate to speak to me about it and talk to me. I'll be glad to discuss anything I say with you. I'm a fallible human being. I have my perspective, but my desire this morning is to see things from a purely biblical perspective and relate them as such. Well, unless you've been in lockdown for the past 3 or 4 weeks without a radio and television, which actually is possible, you know what's been going on in this country and in the world as the result of the death of George Floyd by a police officer in the Minneapolis area. What happened has spurred on so much that we have seen in our society. Literally tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating, even rioting in the streets, protesting police brutality and what's been referred to as systemic racism on the streets of our country as well as in other countries of the world. And I'm going to say right now, what happened to George Floyd was senseless and tragic, and the persons responsible need to be held accountable. And I can't imagine anyone here disagreeing with that assessment. Those things should not happen, and they should not have happened. We see that. We understand that. But there seems to be a strong sentiment that if you do not completely align yourself with those who are protesting, then you are part of the problem and guilty of racism yourself. Anita and I were watching the local news last night, and they were covering a protest over in Silva, you know, and there were hundreds of people marching in Silva. Can you imagine? Hundreds of people marching in the streets of Silva. And some of them had signs. A number of them had signs. Here's a couple of the signs. One I noticed said, "To be silent is to be complicit." And another one said, "Silence equals violence." And the mentality of many seems to be that if you're not out in the streets joining in this movement, if you're not contributing to the cause of those who are protesting or making public announcements in support of all they stand for, that means you have no problem with police brutality or racism. That seems to be an overwhelming sentiment from those who are pro. If you're not with us, you're against us. You know, as Christians, we all recognize there is no place for racism in the heart of the Christian. When Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, he didn't specify what color they were. We don't even have to discuss that. That's not even on the table. We know that is not the case. But what I would like for us to consider this morning is, what is the Christian's responsibility in all this? What is my responsibility? Where should I stand? Should I be out on the street protesting? Or should I be speaking against the protesters? You know, there's no question that police brutality exists in our society. There's no question that racism exists. It's flashed in front of us on the nightly news. But in a nation of 325 million people, does that mean all police are bad and that if you're not joining in this movement, you're a racist? Does that equate with that? Clearly, no Christian should be involved in any kind of rioting or looting or public defacing or defacing of public property. But is it our responsibility as Christians to be joining our voices with those who are protesting these injustices that take place in our society? Out of curiosity, I Googled the phrase, what would Jesus say about George Floyd? I just wanted to see what I can. I love Google because you can get instant results of what the pulse of the nation is, in a sense. And the first page came up, four or five hits, and I read on the first one that seemed interesting to me, and here's the first paragraph from the first thing I read. It said, as Americans take to the streets to protest racial injustice, Christians are asking a familiar question. What would Jesus do? Would he grab a sign and square off against police? Write letters to politicians? Say prayers? The best answer is probably all of the above, according to leaders from various Christian traditions who said faithful protesting comes in many forms. And that's from a place called the Deseret News. Never heard of them. Doesn't matter. But I read a number of articles on that same hit page. The same. I didn't even have to go to the next page. And the overwhelming sentiment is that Jesus' followers should be, out in the streets speaking against what has happened and lending their voices with those who are protesting. Well, is that true? If Jesus were living here today in this world at this time, is that what he would say we should do? Is that what we as Christians should be doing? It's a legitimate question. Well, the wonderful thing is we don't have to speculate as to what his response would be, because we can know exactly what Jesus would do and say because we have his words recorded for us as to what he did do and say. And before we consider that, I think it's important to recognize one thing. The historical and cultural context in which Jesus lived and taught his followers. Think about it. Jesus himself lived in a corrupt society where injustice was rampant, where those in power abused their authority, where people were unjustly treated and oppressed because of their race or their religion or their point of view, where brutality by those who were in authority existed. In those respects, Jesus lived in a world that is not much different than the world we live in today, didn't he? And all we have to do is look at the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus himself, and we will see all of these things taking place, things far more brutal than anything we've seen on the evening news. So the context in which Jesus taught can be equated with what's going on in our society today. He had those same things he was dealing with, and he was even a victim himself of them at the cost of his own death. This is the very culture in which Jesus lived, the culture in which he taught, and the culture in which, when we read the words of the New Testament, these things were said. Okay. But we also have to consider one other thing, and that's we have to consider his words not just in the historical and cultural context in which he lived, but in the context of his very purpose for coming to this world. Because if we don't understand why Jesus came to this earth, then we completely miss the point of everything he taught. We miss it completely. And I think people are missing the point left and right in this world. They don't understand why he came to this earth. Well, what was Jesus' purpose for coming to this earth? Turn, you would, in your Bibles to Matthew 6, verses 9 and 10. And I know we're all familiar with these, but we're going to spend most of our time in the Sermon on the Mount this morning, by the way, with a few other references. But when Jesus was teaching his disciples how to pray in the Sermon on the Mount, what did he teach them? What is the beginning of that prayer? Pray then in this way: Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy kingdom come. That was Jesus' emphasis, the coming of God's kingdom. What did he say when Pilate asked him if he were a king of the Jews before Pilate at the trial? What did he say? My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. The very kingdom Jesus is speaking about is a kingdom that was prophesied in the Old Testament. We can read what that kingdom was to be about. And turn over to Isaiah, if you would, and we'll read one passage from the Old Testament. And we could read many prophecies. This one, I felt, kind of said it in as concise a way as possible. This is Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4. And I know these passages are familiar to us. And I know I'm probably speaking to people who know all these things. But it's helpful to be reminded with everything going on around us. Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations and will render decisions for many peoples, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. This is the kingdom that Jesus Christ came to this earth to establish. You know, his primary concern was not with the kingdoms and nations of this world. We have to understand that. That was not his emphasis. It was a spiritual kingdom he was concerned about. And I think it's interesting that in the temptation, in the wilderness, what was one of the things that Satan offered him? If you bow down and worship me, I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. Jesus wasn't interested in that whatsoever. He's not interested in changing kingdoms or governments. He's interested in changing the hearts of men and women, and that's why he came to this earth. That was his purpose, to establish a heavenly kingdom that all saved men and women of all nations. Did you catch that in Isaiah? All nations, many peoples, would flow into all colors, all ethnicities. They could all be part of it and live in peace and harmony. And isn't that exactly what we see in the church? The heavenly representation of that, the earthly representation of that heavenly kingdom? Turn over to Galatians chapter 3, one passage that just occurred to me. Galatians 3, 26. For you are all sons of God, beginning in verse 26. For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free man. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. Where do racial distinctions disappear? Where do ethnic distinctions disappear? Where do class distinctions disappear? Even sex distinctions, in a sense? In God's kingdom, in His heavenly kingdom. The kingdom that Jesus Christ came to establish. You know, the problem is that people believe that Jesus came to this earth to make this world a better place. That's not why He came here. We have to understand this. He did not come here to rid this earth of injustice. He did not come to rid this world of poverty or hatred or inequality or bigotry or any other injustice you can think of. He did not come to make this world a better place to live. Do we really get that? Do we understand that? That was not His purpose for coming to this earth. He came to this earth to establish a spiritual kingdom where none of those things exist. And that is the church, His heavenly kingdom on earth. The church He purchased with His own blood. Well, how does Jesus describe the citizens of that kingdom? You know, the question we have before us is what should our response be to all the protests, all the demands, all the things going on in our country and in the world? What should our response be as Christians? Well, let's look how He describes the citizen of the kingdom of heaven, and that we find in the Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to go through these, and I think I have time to make a few comments about each of them. They're important. But look at Matthew 5 is where the Sermon on the Mount begins, and we'll read the first couple verses just to introduce the sermon. And when He saw the multitudes, He went up on the mountain, and after He sat down, His disciples came to Him, and opening His mouth, He began to teach them, saying, first of all, verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit. I just want you to imagine what that means. And I think primarily what it means is how we see ourselves compared to God. I think Peter the Apostle is the perfect example of that attitude. When we see him casting out the net after fishing all night at Jesus' command and catching the great catch of fish, and the disciples are astounded, and Peter realizes then something about Jesus, that this is not a man. This is not much more than a man. And what does he do? He falls to his knees, and he says, depart from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. That's how we have to see ourselves in comparison to God. We need to see ourselves from that perspective and respond accordingly. I remember back, I had to look it up just to be sure, but I think it was 2013 I read that a celebrity and her husband were driving home from a party in Atlanta, and they were pulled over because the husband was suspected of being intoxicated behind the wheel. I don't know what the result of that was, but it was clear that the celebrity herself was intoxicated. And she got out of the car and she began yelling at the officer, "Do you know my name? Don't you know who I am?" And the officer said, I could care less who you are, lady. I mean, that was his response. That's the opposite of being poor in spirit. To think that you are something because of something you have done, because of something you have achieved in this life, or because of something you've been through. We cannot see ourselves as anything before God or before one another. We are spiritually destitute and have nothing to offer God, and we need to see ourselves and one another the same way. We are all equal in that. No matter what's happened to us, we have no special right to any behavior by anybody whatsoever. We are destitute before God. And I believe there's a reason this is the first characteristic mentioned of those who would be citizens of God's kingdom in this sermon. Because unless we first see ourselves as poor in spirit and empty ourselves before God, then He cannot fill us with His Spirit. He has to start with an empty vessel, and unless we're empty, He doesn't have what He needs to start with. Verse 4, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." You know, these characteristics are not pick and choose. Well, I'm going to pick the, hunger and thirst for righteousness, but, those others, that's not for me. We can't do that. These are all interconnected and overlap. We cannot have one without having all of them. That's the way it works. And I believe this morning Jesus speaking about here is really in connection to the recognition of our spiritual poverty. We mourn because we recognize where we stand before God, what we have done. And the recognition is that He is the one who can fill us, that He is the one who can comfort us when we recognize that He is the only one who can do anything about our emptiness, the only one who can truly bring us comfort. Verse 5, "Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth." Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. You know, the Greek word translated gentle, or more commonly meek here, that is what we typically hear, is the identical Greek word used to describe a wild animal that has been tamed. It's not that the animal has given up its power. The animal isn't weak. It's given up its will to its master. And that's what we as Christians need to make sure we do. We give up our wills to God when we become citizens of His kingdom. And there has been a lot of speculation as to what it means to inherit the earth. And I would suggest, Rick Harrington, that what it means in this context is that it is only those who have submitted their wills to God who can truly appreciate and find fulfillment in the world that He has created for us. Because it's only those who view it from the proper perspective. What did Jesus say in John chapter 10, 9 and 10? He said, "The thief comes in, breaks in to steal and destroy, but I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly." It's only when we recognize why this world was created and who created it and what His purpose is for us in this world that we can truly enjoy the things of this world as they were meant to be enjoyed. Not as our end in all, but as blessings from a loving and caring Creator. I think that's what that means to inherit the earth. We really get it. We get what it was purposed for. Verse 6, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. You know that the Greek word for hunger here is the same Greek word used to identify how Jesus felt after he had fasted for 40 days in the wilderness? This isn't just my father-in-law, he said he had an old man work for him for years, and they'd be driving home from working out in the field, and her dad, Earl, would say, he'd say, "I'm starving." And that fellow would look and said, "Mr. Earl, you're not starving, you're lunchy." This is not lunchy. This is starving. This is not a passing desire, but a driving force. That's the type of hunger for righteousness the citizen of God's kingdom needs to have, a driving force. You know, when I was a kid, I loved Star Trek. That was one of my favorite shows to watch, you know, and I saw all of them. And you know, the Starship Enterprise was part of the Federation. And if you all remember, those who watched it, the Federation had a prime directive. I don't know if you remember, that played into a lot of the episodes, the prime directive. And the prime directive was that you did not interfere with that planet's culture or anything that would change anything about it. You know, whatever their rules were, you abided by, whatever. You didn't try to change anything. And everything they did was with the prime directive in view. Well, hungering and thirsting after righteousness is the Christian's prime directive. Everything we do should be with that in view. Seek ye first. Prime. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And all this other stuff that you worry about will take care of itself. That's a paraphrase, but I really believe that's the point Jesus is making. You put me first and my will first, then you don't have to worry about anything else that's going on in this world. Verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. You know, we talk a lot about grace and mercy, and it's easy to confuse those two terms, I think. And the way I always remember it is grace is defined as showing someone favor that they don't deserve. We get that one. Unmerited favor is what we typically say. Showing someone favor that they don't deserve. Mercy is defined as not giving somebody the punishment they deserve. That's the difference. One is getting something that you are not worthy of, and one is not getting what you're really worthy of, which is punishment or retaliation or whatever. And I'm just going to let Jesus comment on what he means by this. Look over at verse, I think, is what, if we look over at chapter 5, verse 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, Do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. You know what really Jesus is saying here? Is the reason you do these things is for the sake of influence. So people can see that you are different, that you're not of the type who wants to retaliate, who wants to condemn, who wants to fight. But you want, for your influence sake and for his influence sake, not do these things. Be merciful to those who have wronged you. Because isn't that what he has done for us? That we've wronged God and he is merciful to us. Verse 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And I know I speak on this passage quite a bit. I think it's such a crucial thing to understand. And it this can't mean sinless. How do I know that? Because none of us are going to see God because we're all sinful. We've all sinned. So there's something else being said here. Years ago, I had a roommate in college. I'll mention him just so if you ever see him, you can embarrass him. Steve Houchin, great friend of mine, best man in my wedding. But Steve came home from the mall late one night, frustrated and tired. And he had parked his car, you know, and then went in shopping or to see a movie. I can't remember exactly what it was. And when he came back out, he couldn't find his car. He thought he knew where he parked, but he couldn't find it. And he spent literally 2 hours walking up and down every row in the mall parking lot on that side of the mall trying to find his car. You know, they didn't have the little key fobs back then where you could hit your horn or something. And he was about to call the police and report it stolen. And then it occurred to him, oh, my car's in the shop. And he borrowed another roommate's car to go to the mall. The reason he couldn't find the right car is because he was looking for his own car. He was looking for his own car so he couldn't see the car that he actually needed to see. We do that with the truth. And we walk right past it. We don't see it even when it's right in front of us because we've already determined in our hearts what the truth is. So when it is revealed to us, we can't even see it. And what I believe Jesus is saying here is we will only see God and His will for what He and it truly is if we are seeking Him with pure hearts, hearts that are free from our own preconceived and predetermined notions and agendas. And so often people read the Bible seeking to justify what they've already decided is the case. Jesus would be out protesting. I'm having trouble seeing that here, and we're going to read on here in a minute. Verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Turn over to Ephesians with me. I think this is a beautiful passage. It's Ephesians 2, 14 and 15. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one, and those both groups are Jews and Gentiles, divided by race, at enmity with one another because of really the law and the separation that the law, it seems to me, prescribed. The Jews weren't supposed to have the attitude they did. They took it too far, but they were supposed to be separated. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace. If we truly want to be peacemakers, then our desire will be to bring others into God's kingdom where we can be one man together, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of origin, regardless of class, regardless of whatever else you want to throw out there, what we've done in our past. We can be one with one another and have peace. And that's the peacemaking, I believe, that we are supposed to be. Peace with God that brings peace with one another. And finally, we read all these characteristics of how the citizens of God's kingdom are to be gentle, they're to be meek, they're to be peacemakers, they're to turn, you know, all these things we could talk about, poor in spirit. And here's the result of how they're going to be treated. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. What does Jesus say here regarding those who would be citizens of his kingdom. That they are going to be insulted. They're going to experience injustice, having evil spoken of them, being falsely accused. They are going to be persecuted because of their loyalty to him. And what do we see played out in the pages of the New Testament? That followers of him were persecuted, imprisoned, put to death because of their loyalty to Jesus Christ. You know, none of us have had to experience imprisonment, I don't think, because of our faith, or have been persecuted to the point of death. I'm sure that's not the case because you're here. But how many times have we heard Christians being ridiculed because of their belief in creation, or insulted, called bigots because of their stances on morality and things such as that? It happens. And there may come a time, and it may be soon, where we are persecuted even beyond that. But how does Jesus tell his followers to respond when these things happen? Does he tell them to protest the injustice? Does he tell them to make demands of those who are in authority? That's not what he tells them to do. It says, rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. Where is our focus supposed to be? It's supposed to be on heaven, on the spiritual kingdom. And please correct me if you think I'm mistaken. And I thought about this even, and I'm thinking about it before I say it. It seems to me that the only demand that Jesus ever made of anyone were demands that he made of his followers. Those are the only demands he ever made of anyone, were of his followers. You know, this country we live in grants us the right, according to the law, to peacefully protest injustice and equality. And it is a matter of personal judgment, I believe, to what extent we involve ourselves in those things, and some things are different than others, obviously. Some causes may mean more to us than others. And we can spend our time being involved in various causes and protests and demonstrations in an attempt to make this world a better place, to make this world a utopia, so to speak. But what we have to remember, that all our attempts to do that are ultimately going to fail. As long as men and women are in charge of what that society is going to look like. And I don't know hardly any Latin at all, but I do know one Latin word, utopia. Do you know where that word literally means in Latin? No place. It doesn't exist. Not on this earth, anyway. It doesn't exist. And ultimately, what should matter to the Christian, to you and to me, is not ridding this world of injustice and bigotry and brutality, but ridding our hearts of all of those things. And in so doing, demonstrating the love and compassion and mercy and grace of Jesus Christ to our fellow man without prejudice. That's what should matter to us. One final passage. 1 John chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, and then the lesson will be yours. 15 through 17, excuse me. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lust. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. I appreciate your time. It looks like I went a little over. But I hope you forgive me for that and are merciful. You know, this lesson did not touch on what it takes to become a Christian in terms of how we become one, but it did talk about what it means to be a Christian and what it requires. If you know what you need to do, if that appeals to you, we would encourage you to think about that. We'd be glad to study with you further. But if you know what you need to do to be saved at this time and would like us to assist you in that, we'd be glad to do that as we stand and sing the invitation song. Or if you would like to study or have other conversations about or need anything else, you may please come forward or let us know after the service as we sing the song of invitation. Thank you.